Welcome to It's All Journalism. I'm Michael O'Connell. Mark every death, remember every victim, follow every case. These are the words on the banner of Homicide Watch DC, a community-driven reporting project covering every murder case in Washington, D.C. Today we're joined by Laura Amico, the founder and the driving force behind Homicide Watch DC. I'm speaking to her from New England, where she's currently a Nieman Berkman Fellow at Harvard University. Good morning, Laura.
Hi, good morning.
Your website kicked off in August 2011. Where did you get the inspiration for it?
We actually started in September of 2010. We launched on WordPress, and we relaunched on the custom platform that you see now in August of 2011. That relaunch really gave us a lot of steam and created the website that we'd always imagined building. On the WordPress site, we'd been able to learn the rhythm of courts coverage, of crime coverage, and what the community was looking for. With the custom platform that we relaunched on, we built out those database features, the victim pages, the suspect pages, that have really become the heart of the site.
You know, I really love this site, and I hope the people who listen to this check it out, because some of my background is in community journalism, and I can tell you, crime reporting, people love reading crime reporting. B, it's an incredible community service. And three, it's just incredibly interesting, and we'll go to D. A lot of this information is available, and it really is just a matter of going out there and being a reporter and digging for it. So, tell me about your background and how you got into this.
Yeah, I started as an education reporter, and then I moved to general assignment and then the crime beat, which was not a beat that I was interested in, but it was the job that was available, and so I told my editors that it was really my dream job, and they believed me. The joke was on me because I really did just fall in love with the crime beat.
That once you get into it, you suddenly realize the breadth of it and the impact it can have in just your coverage. But go on, please.
Let's see. I was a crime reporter at the Santa Rosa Press-Democrat, and Chris, my husband, was hired by the PBS NewsHour out in Washington, D.C., so we moved from California to D.C., Unfortunately, in 2009, no one was hiring crime reporters, let alone local reporters, for the most part. So I spent a year freelancing and sort of just, really wanting to get back to the state that I'd enjoyed so much. I was trying to follow some homicide cases from my neighborhood because I wanted to get to know the city that I was living in and who my neighbors were and what was happening in their lives and whether or not my neighborhood was, in fact, safe. And so I went, when homicides happened in my neighborhood, I went to the local media to find out what there was to know. I found those reports to be very basic and lacking in what I was looking for, which was primarily the follow-up of what happened after this person was killed. How was this death being experienced in the community, and what was happening in the criminal justice system? Because I was freelancing and not really enjoying the work that I was doing at that point, I started kicking around this idea for a website that would build more complete coverage and build in more voices from the community. I'm very fortunate that my husband is a web developer, and we were able to work on this project together.
So what was it that, in your impression, what is it, maybe why was the local press sort of not going into the depth that maybe you thought that they should be? Do you have any idea or any?
D.C. has come down in the number of murders so much. There were under 100 homicides last year. That's down from a high of, over 500 in the 90s each year.
Back when it was considered the murder capital of the country.
Right, exactly. And I think that's a volume that's hard for anyone to really wrap their head around. But it also set a standard of news values in terms of determining which cases to cover. And that as the number of murders declined, the media was still using those old news values of which neighborhoods were most affected, which homicides in which neighborhoods deserved attention, and making judgments perhaps about what the root cause of various homicides were. And that as the crime situation in D.C. changed, those news values weren't, and it created this gap within the community.
Do you think they were using sort of a racial or a socioeconomic, you know, yardstick to saying, well, you know, these neighborhoods will certainly will report the murder, but these neighborhoods, mm-hmm. these aren't our listeners or our viewers or our readers.
I think it had to do with so many of the homicides in the past having to deal with the crack epidemic and that really not being so much of a problem anymore. We used to hear from people, you know, all the homicides in D.C. are just drug deals gone bad. And that's really, really not the case anymore. But that was the assumption that was being used to justify or not justify coverage.
So I started out this interview, you know, stating your motto, which is you mark every death, remember every victim, mm-hmm. follow every case. You know, how do you do that?
Well, the first step is by making the best use of our reporting as we can. What you see on the front end is a very sophisticated back end of a database that collects all of the information that we're reporting. So the first step that a reporter does in covering a case is that they go into the database and they enter what they know. That might just be a date, a time, and location. It might include a victim name, age, race, gender, circumstance, who the detectives are assigned to the case, and so on, you know, going through the criminal justice system. Having that information in the database helps us keep track of, one, what we know and what we don't know, two, where we need to focus our reporting efforts if there are holes in the cases that we're covering, and three, it helps us just keep track of where cases are. We always know what the next court date is for a case. We always know the status of the case at any given time, and that helps us, you know, not have to redo a lot of the work again and again when, you know, 6 months after the preliminary hearing, we're now in pretrial motion. We don't have to go back and do a lot of catch-up.
Yeah, and that's actually one of the things I really like about your site is that it's not just, you know, John Smith here committed this crime, you know, he's been arrested, and then you don't really hear about it until months later.
Right.
When there's a resolution, mm-hmm. that you can, you know, you can look up by the name, you can look up by the location, mm-hmm. and you can sort of follow that case as it progresses. Having followed this process, do you see sort of, do you have sort of a greater understanding then of how this sort of unfolds?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I've learned through working on this site that's been just really fascinating for me is that we've traditionally treated crime news as breaking news. And in reality, the community treats it much more as evergreen-type news, that we see people coming back to these pages that we're creating for victims and suspects, coming back to individual stories and photos and the photo galleries and the documents again and again. And they're coming back to these resources on a timeline that I really can't anticipate. I watch my analytics very carefully, and sometimes, you know, I'll see, you know, a spike in one particular story or a victim page or a suspect page. And I'll think, God, you know, I haven't had anything new in that case in months. You know, why this sudden interest? And I'll dig into it a little bit and see that, oh, perhaps it's the person's birthday or it's the mother's birthday or there's a family reunion, something like that. And it's really just proven to me that for the community, these stories don't end in the news cycle. They continue on 2 years for sure, certainly, because that's about the length of time that it takes a case to go to trial in D.C., but on much longer than that as they continue to grieve and think about and try to understand these experiences.
Yeah, and that's it. That's sort of the incredible thing that when you see something like this, it's not just a crime blotter. This is something mm-hmm. that's sort of living. That it's mm-hmm. a story that can, you know, is constantly unfolding. That there are new things that you learn, and new parts of it that become prominent.
I love that we can talk about a Homicide Watch site in terms of it being a living resource.
Yeah. Oh no.
I think that's just really incredible.
No, and you know, you do get kind of inured to the, you know, the statistics, the breaking news of, you know, there's been, you know, another shooting, you know, wherever. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. you know, you'll see a face on the TV for a few seconds, and mm-hmm. it just sort of moves on. And you know, these murders, you know, obviously they impact the person who's killed, but they impact the family. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that I really enjoy about your site, or I really admire about your site, is that it goes that extra step. It sort of opens this up to feedback mm-hmm. from the community. Can you tell me how that sort of works?
Our goal from the beginning was to provide as much context as possible, because my belief is that more context builds more understanding, which builds greater conversations. And what we really want to have happen is to have people have deep, meaningful conversations that perhaps lead to change based on what they're learning and understanding from Homicide Watch DC. My sense in both covering crime and reading crime news always was that I didn't have a real understanding of the context in which these crimes were occurring. Again, determining the newsworthiness of any particular case, I didn't know how those decisions were being made. I think that with Homicide Watch DC, what we try to do is provide as granular a level as you're interested in, but then also that highest overview level that you might be interested in as well. My hope is that you might come into Homicide Watch DC, perhaps, you know, on a victim page or a suspect page, and you'll see in either the left-hand or the right-hand sidebar some data points there. I'm looking at a victim page right now for a young man who died November 17th, 2012, and I see that he's 18 years old, male, black, and the cause of death is stabbing. Now, I might be interested in this particular case, but what I also hope would happen is that you might say, well, who else was killed in a stabbing? Who else was 18 years old or black or male? And that you'd start going deeper beyond, okay, this happened to this young man. Who else did this happen to? What were the similarities and differences between these two cases? Why is one different from the other? And what does that tell me about the problem of homicide in my neighborhood?
Now, are you able to, I mean, you present this data. Are you doing any reporting or writing, you know, separate from just the coverage of these murders, looking at some of this data and saying, you know, why is there suddenly all of these, you know, all of this, these shootings? Why are in this area? I mean, are you writing any bigger stories or are you just sort of presenting?
Yeah, no, certainly. In December, we just published our second annual year in review package. I'm opening it up here now. We had a sit-down interview, which we video recorded, with Police Chief Kathy Lanier, where she talked about specific homicide cases during the year that she thought, you know, had been particularly meaningful, as well as trends in homicides in the district over time. We also do a pretty deep analysis of our data. If you were to look at 2012 by the numbers, you see just a whole list of data points that we've been able to pull out of our database. For example, you know, the first one, there were 92 homicides this year in 91 separate incidents. 4 deaths were ruled self-defense or justifiable homicide by citizen and won't be counted in official statistics. 84 victims were male, 8 were female. The oldest was 69 years old. The youngest was a baby who died just after being delivered. I mean, these are things that we can pull out of our database quite quickly. And we do it at other times during the year, too, if, you know, we feel like there might be something specific happening, some sort of trend or, you know, something interesting. But we also do it every December for a large year-end package.
So what has been the response from the community?
Really, really interesting. When I started just the WordPress site in September of 2010, I started it really quietly because I didn't really know what I was doing. I had this sense of, you know, I had these skills as a crime reporter. There was coverage that I was looking for in the community, but I was still very much an outsider. I just moved to DC from California, and I didn't know if my needs were the same as the community's needs. We had 500 page views our first full month in October of 2010. Let me pull this up just now. Well, we now average 10,000 page views a day. So that's in, you know, two and a half years of growth. And that's with one reporter on the site. We have three interns on the site right now, equaling about 1.25 FTEs. So the community response was just tremendous. It was natural. There was nothing that we did as far as, you know, pushing the site out through promotion, through putting it on, you know, listservs, nothing like that. People found it on their own, and still, you know, a lot of our traffic comes in through search. And I think this speaks to the ways that people in the community, you know, are trying to access and interact with information about these crimes, is that they're putting names and addresses into Google. So they're saying, I know something happened on Fifth Street last night. I know something happened to this girl, Selena, who I went to high school with. And they're putting that into Google. And Google sending them to Homicide Watch DC. So that's been really interesting to me. The other thing is that I knew coming in as an outsider that I didn't want my voice to be the primary voice on the site. So I went, you know, with a very strict, very voiceless AP style for all of the writing and reporting. And I tried to build a safe commenting community so that people would feel as though they could leave comments about the cases and the people and what they were experiencing. We try to highlight as many of those comments as we can by pulling them out of the threads and calling them comments of the day, because we want to try and elevate the community voices and help people feel like they are a part of this conversation and that their experiences are valid.
So, and I know that that's one of the important parts about this site that we've just sort of been talking around, is that people do leave comments, people post photos. This is, you know, they've, you know, I think you said before, you know, AP keeping it sort of your voice out of it. I think that serves you really well, because then that opens you up for people to sort of fill that void with their own stories, their own perspective. You know, tell me about how that sort of grew as the site went on.
Well, the comments got better and better and better. I worked really hard on our comments policy, and we pre-moderate all of our comments. And I think that that's helped us build a safe space. There's historically been a big problem with online comments related to crime stories. And I didn't want this site to involve any of that, those personal attacks, the swearing, the, you know, language, that sort of thing that you typically see. So we decided to pre-moderate. What that has meant is that we're able to shut down any problems before they start. You know, if someone posts a comment, you know, with a personal attack, a threat, anything like that, it doesn't get posted. So the comments never devolve down that path. But it's also raised the level of comments that people feel like this is a safe space for them to really say what they think and what they're feeling. And that's one of the things I'm most proud of on the site.
Do you have a particular comment that sort of, that you remember that sort of jumps out at you?
Yeah,
that...
you know, a couple. Yeah, there's one from a while ago now, maybe a year and a half ago. A suspect's father wrote in, actually, and said, "My son tells me he's innocent and I have to believe him." And that was a really meaningful comment for me, because suspects' families so rarely have voices in coverage of crime. And I know from sitting in the courtroom with both victim families and suspect families that in many cases both families are experiencing losses, that victims' families are afraid of what's going to happen. They might not understand what's happening in the court system. And they're trying to understand, too, how they came to be in this situation. And I love that we've been able to provide a space for them to feel like they can share those concerns and those experiences as well. Another one of my favorite comments came from a nurse, an emergency room nurse, who said, wrote in saying that she had been on duty when a shooting victim was brought in, and she didn't know this young man and she didn't know his family, but she wanted them to know that they did everything that they could to save his life. That comment to me showed just the incredible depth of this community of people that can be affected by these cases, and that it's perhaps a much larger community than we ever imagine. That it's the families, for sure, but it's also the nurses and doctors and ambulance drivers and teachers and social workers, you know, everyone who's in this system and in this community, and it just reaches much farther than I thought.
Yeah, and I think what you described is what I find so amazing about this site. That, and again, your neutral voice serves this so well, because any point of view that you would add to it is not going to raise the drama or the interest or, you know, the humanity of this moment or this story that's going on. You're just sort of providing the space for it to exist.
Right. I try to remember, you know, these aren't my stories. These aren't my experiences, and it's not my voice that matters or how I tell the story that matters. The goal is to be a moderator, a space, a place to have the conversation.
You've definitely, you know, caught the attention of a lot of people in media. You've received a lot of awards. You know, we started this out. You said that you're a Nieman Berkman Fellow at Harvard. the Knight Public Service Award from the Online News Association. Uh-huh. You were named an OpenGov champion by Sunlight Foundation, and you know the Columbia Journalism Review, The Atlantic, New York Times have all written about you. As a journalist, what is your takeaway? What do you feel? How do you feel about that?
Oh boy, it's incredible. I mean, we fought for so long for people to recognize the site as journalism. We did it outside of, you know, the traditional legacy newsrooms without any grant or financial support. And there is a lot of question for a long time, and perhaps there still is, about, you know, what exactly is this site? Is this, you know, a news service when it's not operating within, you know, the large media world of D.C.? The Nieman Berkman Fellowship, ONA, National Press Foundation honors, all of that just proves that there are so many people doing journalism and doing good work on their own outside of the traditional structures. And it's so great to have that recognized.
Yeah, I certainly can't imagine this being done, you know, economically in a print environment, certainly with the depth that you've been able to do it and the interactivity. I think the interactivity, you know, which you're only going to find in an online environment, really, mm-hmm. really serves you well in the way you're telling these stories and the way you're interacting with the community. Is it journalism? Mm-hmm. Is it just a community blog? You know, what is it? I mean, I think people recognize that whatever it is, whatever this animal, whatever this elephant in the dark is, this is, you know, a very powerful vehicle for a lot of people. Now, you mentioned sort of, you know, starting the site and you did sort of mention the financial aspect of it. You know, how is this financed?
Yeah, Chris and I bootstrapped it for 2 years, just, you know, running it spit and duct tape and whatever we could, because we believed in it. We were lucky. Chris was working full-time for the NewsHour and then full-time for NPR as a developer and worked nights and weekends on the project. And his salary there allowed me to work on the project full-time and build it into what it is today. There's a point about a year and a half ago when we were figuring out how to make it sustainable and thinking about applying to become a nonprofit and all of that. And I suddenly realized that we'd built this software, we'd built this product, and that, you know, at these conferences that I was going to, reporters kept asking me, you know, how can I do what Homicide Watch does? And so we realized, well, maybe, you know, we can combine that need with the product that we've developed and actually provide this product to newsrooms so that those reporters can use this tool, which is how we are now supporting the business through those licensing agreements. We work with Digital First Media to do Homicide Watch Trenton in partnership with the Trentonian, and now with the Chicago Sun-Times to do Homicide Watch Chicago, which will be up and running in just a couple of days now.
And is that going to be part of they're going to staff that with some of the regular reporters?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're responsible for the staffing, all of the reporters and editors, and running the site's day-to-day operations. We provide the software and any consulting or editorial support that they need as far as approach.
Now, Trenton, Chicago, D.C., these are cities of a certain size. Is this a model that can be translated to, you know, smaller markets, do you think?
Yeah, Trenton actually is a smaller market. Let me look up here real fast how many homicides they had last year.
I know Trenton's not Chicago. But, you know, Podunk, Idaho, or wherever, who may have like one or two murders a year. One would hope that Podunk, Idaho, had one or two murders, that their local paper would spend a lot of time covering that.
Right. One would hope.
One would hope.
the idea of the software is that it helps a newsroom provide that place for conversation within a community that is seeking to have that conversation. Mm-hmm. And we've seen that in Trenton, that there are people there who want to talk about the problem of homicide. They're looking for facts and context to have those conversations with, and that Homicide Watch is able to become that place. We think that the same will be true in Chicago, and we think that it's true of a lot of other cities too. You know, a city with one or two homicides a year is probably a different bag of chips.
Mm-hmm. Do you see this model being, you know, translated in any other way to violent crime, to other types of, I don't know, I want to say activities, mm-hmm. or a way to monitor some other type of situation?
Yeah, no, it's funny. One of the requests that we get most often from newsrooms is homicide watch. Yeah, that's great. Can you apply that to schools coverage and education coverage? And it's really an interesting concept, and we're working on a couple different projects right now, actually, where we take the heart of the idea, which is contextual database reporting tied to narratives and built around community conversation, and apply that to other subjects. You know, the software is great, and the tool is an incredible resource for reporters, but I think it's also a journalistic approach of how you think about the purpose of your news, the purpose of your coverage, and how you're engaging your community.
One of the things about this type of coverage, which I think is important, and when it's done well, it can lead to change in places. Have you got any inkling that there's been any type of change because of you being able to provide this platform?
Oh, that's a really hard question.
I ask the hard questions. I'm sorry.
I know. and that's one that people ask a lot. They ask, you know, are there fewer homicides because of Homicide Watch DC? Well, I don't know.
Well, let me ask a similar question, but slightly different.
Yeah.
What's your hope for this? You know, that you set up a site like this, that you're reporting this, that you're telling these stories. What is your hope?
Yeah, well, I have a story that I can tell, actually. I was at the courthouse one day, and a detective pulled me aside and said, Laura, I've got to talk to you. And I said, okay, about what? And he said, well, we pulled this kid in for questioning on a homicide last night. And I said, okay. And he said, we sat the kid down, and the first thing he said was, I ain't done nothing. I've seen Homicide Watch. They're locking people up for that shit now. For me, that was an incredible moment because, you know, whether or not this kid, you know, decided to carry a gun or whether or not he decided to shoot someone based on, you know, his interpretation of whether more people were being arrested for murder in D.C. was really fascinating to me. I mean, they weren't locking any more people up for homicide than they had been before. It's just that this kid knew that these arrests were being made because he'd been on Homicide Watch. And because that information was accessible.
It's
funny. And I think that goes to that community conversation.
Yeah, it's funny. You shine the light. It's funny when you turn the light on what happens, that, you know, people suddenly realize that, oh, you know, maybe somebody's watching me, or maybe, you know, my neighbor is going to comment about me on a board if I get arrested for something, or that suddenly it becomes almost a self-policing mechanism. Very
right.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Very fascinating.
Yeah, my family will know, my teachers will know, whatever it is.
Well, you start to see consequences.
Consequences, exactly. The other thing is that we see the site being a resource for families that are dispersed. So families that, you know, live in multiple states in the area. We have, you know, a lot of families that are split between Washington, D.C. and North Carolina. And, you know, North Carolina is actually one of our highest traffic producing areas because those families are following the court's process of their victims and suspects through Homicide Watch, which is really interesting.
Have you had much interaction with families one-on-one, either in court or just in passing?
Yeah, mostly at the courthouse, which is where most of the reporting happens. But also through responding to comments, you know, if a particularly good comment comes in, as it just happened this morning, a woman wrote in memory of her friend who was just killed late this week. And I emailed her back and said, you know, thank you for your comment. I'm so sorry for your loss. You know, do you have a photo we can use? Is there anything else you'd like to say? That sort of thing. You get to know the families, though, of both the victims and the suspects. There's a suspect's father who I used to see in court all the time. I'm here in Boston now, and the interns are covering the courthouse. But when I was covering the courthouse, I'd see this father at every hearing, which is actually fairly unusual. And at the first hearing, I introduced myself, and he said he didn't want to talk to me. And I said, okay, that's fine. Here's my card in case you change your mind. And he said, no, I'm not going to change my mind. You all knocked on my windows and put TV cameras into my bedroom window. And I said, well, I don't have a TV camera, but I'm very sorry for that. Just so you know, I'm going to be here covering the hearings. You don't have to talk to me, but you can if you want. And we never had an interview. But seeing each other again and again, he knew who I was. I think he began to, you know, realize what I was trying to do. And we started to have conversations. Nothing for the website and nothing about the case, but we did form that relationship, which I was really proud of.
Well, and it's just on a very human level, you have something shared. You know what's going on. He may not have somebody that he feels comfortable, just talking to, because, there's always these, mm-hmm. these unasked questions that he doesn't want to talk about. So it's amazing. Now, what have you learned about community journalism from doing this site?
That's a good question. I've learned that the community is much smarter than I am, that they know things before I do, and that they often understand them better. That's why I try to elevate as many of their voices as possible and to make it as community-driven as I can. I've learned from sitting in the courtrooms that victims' families and suspects' families are often equally at loss for what is happening and both trying to understand how they got to this place, and that valuing both of their experiences as a community narrative of violent crime is really important.
I'm going to wrap this up with a sort of a question that we kind of like to ask everybody who comes in here. There's been a lot of talk, you always hear it, people saying, oh, journalism's dying, that, because all these big papers are dying, that they think that journalism's dying. I think yours is an example that very clearly that journalism can exist in this world in a different way and thrive in a different way. So what are your, I want to ask you, our normal question is, what do you think of the future of journalism, but what do you think is the future of crime journalism at this point?
That's a good question.
Yeah, do you want to just ask the journalism, what do you think is the future of journalism?
I think that we're moving towards a more audience-centric, empathetic journalism. I hope of the type that you see on Homicide Watch, journalism that isn't just about the journalist going out and interviewing someone and interpreting what they say and telling a story about it, but journalism that builds community value and conversation over time.
Well, and I think that Homicide Watch DC definitely is a site that is doing that and is taking journalism in a very different new way in one sense, but in the other, you're actually doing really good journalism. You're covering something dispassionately. You're going in to the courts and covering crime, where a lot of papers and other news outlets aren't able to do that as much as maybe they once were. So we've been speaking today with Laura Amico, from Homicide Watch DC. I highly recommend that you check out this site. How can people follow you on Twitter?
I'm at Homicide Watch for Homicide Watch DC, at Laura Norton, LauraNorton for journalism news, and our website is homicidewatch.org.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for joining me today. I found this really fascinating.
It was a terrific conversation. Thanks.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the changing state of the media. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or find out more information about us at itsalljournalism.com. We'd like to hear what you have to say. If you have topics you'd like us to cover or suggestions about who to interview, email us at editor@itsalljournalism.com. Also look for It's All Journalism on Facebook and follow us on Twitter @AllJournalism.